I like that one. It's a new one. Good morning, church. Man, it's good to be with you this morning. Good to be gathered, as always, with the people of God. It's especially good to be with Forest Mill. I love this body and all that it's come to mean, not just to me and my family, but to our community. I think it is a testimony of faithfulness. It's such a powerful testimony this morning to see the family of Miss Norma. How many great grandchildren did Miss Norma have? Y'all know off the top of my head?
Ten.
Are they all here this morning? All the great grandchildren stand up or just lift them up or throw them up or something. That's 10. That is awesome. Really cool. Y'all can sit down. Such a neat thing. We have a lot of people who are out this morning, and I know there's a lot of people traveling. We're kind of in the midst of that season in our calendar. It's good to have our teens back, and some of them are traveling already, but they're back. They went this last week to Give Kids the World Village down just outside of Orlando, and had a week of service there. I didn't have kids there for the first time in forever, so I didn't get to see the pictures, but I got to talk to Jonathan Tucker, and he said it was a really great week. He was really proud of our teens and the service they did, and just a great testimony of love in the spirit of Jesus Christ giving to those who are in need. Now, despite that, what our teens have done, you know, teens are tricky, right? I mean, this is not new news, but I read this report recently from a lady. Her name was Dr. Nancy Darling. You probably haven't heard of her. She's worked at a few different universities, but when she was at Penn State, she reported that 98% of teens lie to their parents. 98%. This is what she discovered. So parents are like, look at your kids, and they're like, no, I'm a 2%er. And it's a lie. So they lied about what they spent their allowances on, lied about whether they'd started dating, lied about what clothes they put on when they went out of the house, they lied about what movie they went to, they lied about who they went with. They lied about alcohol, drug use, of course. They lied about whether they were hanging out with their friends that their parents disapproved of. They lied about how they spent their afternoons while their parents were at work, right? They come home, what have you been doing? They lied about whether there were chaperones at a party. They lied about whether they rode in cars that were driven by friends under the influence. And yet, 98% of teens say trust and honesty are essential for a good relationship. And depending on their ages when they were surveyed, 96 to 98% said lying is morally wrong. So what is wrong with these kids today? Am I all right? I mean, what is wrong with kids that they believe honesty is important and yet they're lying and they're lying? Except there's one big problem. This was not a study from 2024 or 2023. This was a study from the 1990s, which means all those people are in their 40s now. This is not a problem with our teens today. It's not a problem with the people who were teens then. It's not even a cultural problem, like just in America, because studies across the globe have shown this is a problem many places across the world. The truth is that we as human beings have a problem with the truth. We just don't believe that the truth always applies to us. Now, sure, when we're teens, we lie to our parents, we lie to teachers or authority figures or even our friends. But as adults, we are prone to lying to our bosses, to our spouses, to our children. Some people lie to the guys who check up whether they have the Lord's Supper devotional ready. Worse, We lie to ourselves, and worst of all, we lie to God. And so as we continue our study through the book of Hosea, we see that this is not a recent development, right? A few weeks ago, when we were early in the book of Hosea, back in chapter 2, we saw how God was presenting his case against Israel. Like, you know, you've done wrong things. Here is, and he presented it in legal language, like God is prosecuting a case against Israel for what they've done wrong. And that's been going on. We haven't touched on it much again, but that's been continuing. He's got kind of three main points. We talked about the first two already. Now we've kind of here come to the end, and this is God's final charge, his final legal proceeding against Israel. And at the core of Israel's downfall, their moral collapse, has been this underlying problem of deception. This is what he says, the very last verse in Hosea chapter 11. It's actually the first verse of Hosea chapter 12 in the Hebrew Bible, and it really kind of belongs with that. So we're going to read Hosea 11, 12, and then the first verse of chapter 12. This is what he says. Ephraim, another name for the northern tribe for Israel, Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, Israel with deceit. And Judah, southern kingdom, all of a sudden Judah's getting dragged into this. It's been against Israel the whole time. Now Judah, the southern kingdom, is also getting dragged into this. Judah is unruly against God, even against the faithful Holy One. Ephraim, northern tribe, feeds on the wind. He pursues the east wind all day, and he multiplies lies and violence. Now, if you are unfamiliar with the book of Hosea, there's sort of throughout this entire book been an ongoing true-to-life parable. The prophet Hosea was told by God to marry this woman. She was unfaithful. She cheated on him, had kids with other people. And so just like Hosea's wife, her name was Gomer, how she was lying about her loyalty to her husband, Israel has been lying to God about her faithfulness. And the fact is, God says he has been surrounded with lies. Now that's a big deal, just for God to say, I've been surrounded with lies. That indicates this is not an occasional stumble or misrepresentation. It is habitual. It's built into the relationship at this point between Israel and God. And by that, we mean that the lies have become the basis for the relationship. That everything about their relationship with God is built upon lie after lie after lie. That is, in essence, Israel has forgotten what an honest relationship with God even looks like. They don't even know how to have an honest relationship with God at this point. And all this time, Israel has been looking for meaning. They've been searching for protection, searching for help, by turning to every god out there except for the one true and living God, who is the only one actually capable of helping them. Isn't that ironic? Then we get in real trouble, and we turn to every source for help. Friends, family, government agencies, whatever it is we think can help us, we turn to everyone and everything except for the one that can actually help us, the one true and living God. So Israel has pursued, when they're being threatened by their neighbors, they pursued treaties with Assyria. They sent like expensive gifts down to Egypt, like we're still friends, right? And try to build up their own military. They gathered all this wealth, but none of that matters at all. None of it matters anything. It can't help them at all. Hosea says it's useless. It's like you're chasing the wind. That's what he's talking about. You're pursuing the wind. All this stuff you've been doing, all this lying, cheating, going behind my back, it's like chasing after the wind because it can't help you at all. And now, and that's on like a national level. And now he's going to get down to nitty-gritty. This is everyday life, because deception is not just a national problem. It's a personal problem. He says this later on in chapter 12. The merchant uses dishonest scales and loves to defraud. Ephraim boasts, I am very rich. I've become wealthy. With all my wealth, they will not find in me any iniquity or sin. Okay, well, we've got a little bit of a cultural divide to get across here. First of all, he talks about dishonest scales. So what you had to understand about their transactions, you get under the market, whatever it is you're buying, whether it's spices or fish or whatever, everything is weighed. So you pay according to the weight of whatever it is you're buying. And including your money, by the way, because shekels were different size, so they had different value. So even if it's, you know, we have a standard size coin. Theirs were not so much so because they didn't have the ability to manufacture like that. So even money was being weighed. So merchants would have at least two sets of weights to put on the scale. That, one heavier, one lighter. May even have three sets, a standard, normal, and lighter. But essentially what they were doing is they were like, okay, we're going to put your money on the scale, and they would use the heavy weights, the heavier weights, so that you end up paying 110%, let's say, of what you should be charged. And then they would weigh their goods with they would use the lighter for your money, the heavier for their goods. So you were paying 110% and only receiving 90%. And as a result, they'd gotten pretty wealthy. I mean, this system works. They were using it for a reason. It works so well, and their upper class had accumulated so much wealth that they boasted about their illegally gained wealth. And the only reason they felt free to boast about it was because they thought they were above the law. They believed their dishonesty was not prosecutable. They claimed that no one can make any charges stick against them. So they trust in their power, they trust in their wealth, and they trust in their influence to protect them. They don't trust the legal system that God put in place, and they don't trust God to protect them. They trust their own money, their own power, and their own influence, believing no matter how badly they behave, they can get out of it. Thank goodness that was back then and we don't have to deal with that, right? Thank goodness we don't have two sets of the legal system in our country. And yet, often it's said that there are two legal systems. Even in a great country like our own, even one that has a history of being a great legal system, it often is said that there is one system to deal with the wealthy and another to deal with everybody else. And if you have enough money or enough property or enough political power or enough social capital or whatever it is, that somehow that makes you above the law. So if you're a famous actor and you commit a crime, you aren't treated the same as someone who's living on the street and commits that same crime. I think we can see that's probably been the case. If you're a famous person who is the head of an industry, right? If you're a big wig or a CEO of a Fortune 500 company and you commit a crime, you don't receive the same penalty and aren't treated the same as some poor 18-year-old who's been a high school dropout and is living at home in their mom's basement. Even though you committed the same crime, you're not treated the same, are you? If you're a big-time politician and you've taken in money illegally or you've done something illegal, you're not treated the same as someone who works at the factory in a blue-collar industry. It's just not the same. Israel was experiencing that. They knew that to be the case, and they were bragging about it. We at least have the good sense to sort of, turn to the little, give a little sly wink and say, no, it's all the same, it's all good. But we still believe, like they, that if you have enough money or power, that you're above the law. But God says to them, fortunately, your money doesn't determine your destiny. All of your fine houses, all of your stashes of gold, all this social capital that you've built up will not protect you when God levels his guilty verdict. That ultimately God is the one to decide And it doesn't matter how protected you think you are, God is in charge. So this deception is just woven into the very fabric of Israel, right? But the lies don't stop there. It's not just on a national scale, not just on a personal scale. It is also on a spiritual level, even down below all that. It is at a spiritual level. So they've got deception that's worked its way into their relationship with God. It's in chapter 13, God says, when Ephraim spoke, he's going to talk about their past and compare it to their present. Used to, when Ephraim spoke, people trembled. He was exalted in Israel. But he became guilty of Baal worship and died. Now, they sin more and more. They make idols for themselves from their silver, cleverly fashioned images, all of them the work of craftsmen. In other words, really fine, expensive idols. It's said of these people, or they say, or a better translation might be, they say, like everybody else, your reputation in the world is they say this about you, they offer human sacrifices. They kiss the golden calf. They kiss the calf idols. In other words, that's their ultimate god. So they've been piling up this dishonest gain. Remember, this has been a time of national affluence for the northern kingdom. And they continued through this ascendance of power and wealth. They've continued building more idols, trusting more idols. And many of them are fertility idols. Now, which that we talked about that a little bit. It's not just about your wife having babies, but it's about your herds multiplying, right? More and more sheep or goats or whatever it is you're raising. More your vineyards producing more and more. It's about your money growing, all of that. Fertility applied to all of that. So they've been bowing down to these fertility idols that are supposed to bring life. And God says, it's actually bringing you death. You think you're getting more and more life out of all this stuff out there. And that's ultimately your demise. And they've become so paganized that the problem is not a divided Israel. Now pay attention, church, because this is really important for you and me this morning. The problem is not a divided Israel, where you have some people over here who are worshiping those pagan idols and some people over here who are worshiping the one true God. That's not the problem going on in Israel. The problem going on in Israel is that everyone's standing in the middle and they have synthesized a religion that uses both the pagan gods and the worship of God and forms one brand new religion where you've got worship of Baal and God going on in the same ceremonies, the same sacrifices. It all goes together. And the reason this is really important for you and me, it's because of the danger that it poses to the people of God. Because when we try to join anything else, anything, whether it's idol worship like Israel was doing, or the things that tempt us more today, which would be like even patriotism, anything joined with the worship of God is unacceptable. It's like telling God, dishonestly, we trust you for everything, but also trust this over here. It's like me telling my wife, or in Jose and Gomer's case, we can bring it back to a marital relationship, I promise to be true to you until death, you know, sickness and health, richer or poorer, all that stuff. But I also like this gal over here. It's dishonest. It's what Israel was doing in their worship of God. Saying, God, we trust you for everything, but we also trust Baal. We want to worship you, but we also want to do this over here. We believe you'll protect us, but we're also forming an alliance with Assyria. We believe you're all powerful, but we think we also might need some backup from Egypt. So we also trust, turn to, believe in this other thing. Church, that's what scares me more about Christianity in our country, and not just our country, but I see it, of course, more readily in our own society, more than anything, is that Christians are not just about the Word of God anymore. That in order to be a Christian, you also have to have this other value. And particularly today, it's political power. That you can't just be a Christian, you also have to be a Christian and belong to this political party or that political party. And anytime you do that, you're saying, I believe God, but I think what really has to happen is this politician or that politician, but this one, if this one comes in, Christianity is doomed, and if that one comes in, Christianity is saved. And trusting in anything outside the God, the one true and living God, is a danger and a threat to the people of God. We cannot, and we should not, we ought never trust in anyone except for God. To do so is dishonest. It's what Israel is doing, and I believe it's a very real threat for the church in America today. Now, someone, one of my friends in this ministry group was talking about, you know, I'm seeing real problems within our congregation as the political divide widens in our country. I don't know what to do about it. So people were suggesting different sermon series, and I just said, I'm preaching to the minor prophets. And sure enough, people were like, well, that ought to stir the pot. Because the minor prophets are so relevant for you and I today. The issues that Israel and later Judah are struggling with are exactly what we're seeing today. I am not advocating that you have to vote for one person or the other. I don't care. I think you can be a faithful Christian and vote lots of different ways. And you're going to be my brother and sister regardless of who you vote for. This is not about that at all. This is about us trusting in anything except God. This is about trying to synthesize or join anything else with following God and the dangers that poses to the church as the light to the world. My prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation is that we will be a people who are known for upholding God the Father, His Son Jesus Christ, through life in the Spirit. And that no matter what else differences we may have, we unite under the banner of Jesus Christ. And if we can pray for you this morning, encourage you, lift you up for strength, for forgiveness, for new life to be born into the body of Christ, to put on that blood of Jesus that we talked about this morning and be brought into a family that cannot be divided over silly pettiness. If we can help you in any way this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?